Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. I seek refuge, protection with Allah. من الشيطان, away from Shaitan. الرجيم, the rejected, the cursed enemy. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. With Allah's name, the merciful, benefactor, the merciful redeemer. Assalamu alaikum. God peace be with you. Today is July 31st, 2022. And we're going to have a repeat program that we played 5 years ago, July of 2017. And the topic is, how did enslaved Africans become Christians and then became Muslims? With special guests, two esteemed guests, both are PhDs in their field. One is Dr. El Hadid from from Nashville, Tennessee. He was a professor at Tennessee State for many years, Dr. El Hadid. And the other guest is Dr. Derek Barber King, like you go to get your haircut, right? Derek Barber King, who also, by the way, is the nephew of Dr. Martin Luther King. So we're going to begin that shortly. But first, we want to share announcements of encouragement. Please support our newspaper, the Muslim Journal. That is our paper, our institution. And we want to buy subscriptions to the paper. Go to MuslimJournal.net. It's spelled the way it sounds. MuslimJournal.net, M-U-S-L-I-M, journal.net. And subscribe to this wonderful historical newspaper. Also, a note that the headquarters of Muslim Journal is in transition, moving from the home base of Chicago, Illinois, and moving to Newark, New Jersey. We have a board of directors with the paper, and the base of the paper is moving from Chicago to Newark, New Jersey. So with that said, we're going to begin our program, and you're going to hear some of these songs and some commercials, but that's part of being on the radio. They're not my commercials, but they are commercials. So we're going to begin our program. And again, this is a repeat program from 5 years ago, but a very good topic. So you would not be able to interact, but you can take notes. So let us begin our program on how enslaved Africans became Christians and then Muslims with Dr. El Hadid and Dr. Derek King.
Apparently, you've been ordering Domino's new bread twists as a decoy to keep others away from your pizza. Only you suddenly wanted more bread twists for yourself. There are worse things than choosing between either pizza or warm dunkable bread twists and flavors like Parmesan, garlic, and cinnamon, like deciding between going to the dentist or DMV. So when it comes to giving you the best tasting problem you've ever had, sorry, you're welcome.
Order any two or more of Domino's new bread twists or medium two-topping pizzas for $5.99 each. Two-item minimum handmade pan pizzas may be extra. You must ask for this limited time offer. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Blog Talk Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, with the name of God, the merciful benefactor, merciful redeemer. A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. We seek us protection with Allah, God, from Satan, the rejected enemy. Dear beloved listeners, thank you for tuning in to Words Made People. We'll be right back after our opening theme song, titled Words Made People, sung by Khadija Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum. Okay, I see what's going on there. Please forgive me. I'm just, dear listeners, I had no idea my phone was on mute. And when I kept getting phone calls from, I guess Dr. Hadid called me and then Mustafa called me, I put my phone on mute. I had no idea how long my phone's been on mute. Okay, so I'm going to, let me go back to the very top of the show. And I thank you all for being patient and waiting for me to get my act together. I'm waiting for my co-host to call back, Brother Mustafa. So let me just go back to the very beginning as if I had not said anything to you all since the song quit playing. We go back to the very beginning. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Reading from chapter 103 of the Quran. It says, and we say before, in our reading, yet before we read, we say, ask for protection with God from Satan, the rejected enemy. And we say in the English, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. We say that first. And the next we say, in Arabic, Bismillah ar-Rahmanir Rahim, with the name of God, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. We always say that before we read from the Quran. We seek God's protection, and we seek his guidance in reading the Quran. And then we can read from the Holy Quran. And we're going to read from chapter 103, of the Quran. And it's, but we're going to also read the translations from not just from Yusuf Ali, but also the translations from Muhammad Asad, another well-known translator, and also Muhammad Pickthall, another translator of the Quran. Excuse me. But we know the most common one we use often is a Yusuf Ali translation. So let us begin reading. It says, Walasa. And Yusuf Ali says, by the token of time through the ages. But Muhammad Asad, for this same verse, says, consider the flight of time. Consider the flight of time. Because also is time, but it is time that we can measure. As human beings, we can measure this time. And then the Pickthall says, for what also he says, by the declining day, as if it's coming to the end of the day. So it says, for what also, then it says, in now, in sana la si kusri. It says, verily man is in loss. Or as Muhammad Afar says, verily man is bound to lose himself. Or the other translation by Pickthall says, lo, man is in a state of loss. But one thing we know that by the token of time, that man can become lost. Man can lose himself, and man can become lost. Then it says, in the last verse, illa ladina aminu, it says, illa ladina, except for those, or save those. Illa ladina aminu, except those who believe, aminu, the believers. But it doesn't just stop there with beliefs. It says, aminu wa aminu salihat. And that is saying that you have faith, but also you have aminu, works, as salihat, that are good works. So if belief alone doesn't get it, you have to bring with it wa aminu salihat, also good deeds, good work. And then that's for the individual. We have to bring that to it. If we're not going to be lost, we have to be believers who do good works. And then we take it beyond the individual person, and it says, and you're thinking more of a community effort. It says, what the wasal bil haq, and counsel each other. Each other. That's community when we say each other. What the wasal bil haq, and counsel each other in truth. What the wasal bil sabr, and that is to teach each other in being patient, even in adverse times, even in difficult times, that we still counsel each other to be patient, to be consistent with each other. So, again, reading the surah from the beginning, and I do see, I have my co-hosts with me, Brother Lucifer. As-salamu alaykum.
Walaykum as-salam, Brother Emir.
Yes, sir. And I see Dr. El Hadid, he's on too. Dr. El Hadid, assalamu alaikum.
How?
Okay, Dr. El Hadid?
Wa alaikum salam.
Okay, yes, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Yeah, welcome to our show. We're going to finish this reading of the verse, but I'd like to get you the comment from you two. Dr. Derek King will be here. He said at 1:30 prompt. So we're going to hold him to his word. Good, brother. But we're reading chapter 103 of the Quran, titled Walasr, or the Token of Time. But it says, I'm going to read it from the beginning and make for you to offer commentary on it as well. I read it in the Arabic. Walasr, inna insana lafi kusr. إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصل بالحق وتواصل بالصبر. And reading the English translation, I go on this time with the Yusuf Ali translation. Walasr, by the token of time through the ages, إن الإنسان لفي خسر. Verily man is in loss. إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمِنُوا وَعَمِلُوا صَالِحَاتِ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالصَّبْرِ. And he says, except such as have faith and do righteous deeds and join together in the mutual teaching of truth and patience and constancy. So, Brother Mustafa, you have any thoughts or comments you want to share on the reading of Surah Walasr?
Yes, sir, Brother Imam. What gets my attention, Brother Man, when you first read it, about the token of time. And this time, Brother Man, is telling us that it could be measured, but we have to realize time in our sense is different than time in the sense or in the presence of Allah. So this time, Brother Man, this time is waking us up, telling us that if we don't, as believers, if we don't be patient with one another, if we don't do good deeds, righteous deeds, remember Muhammad gave a talk on this, trying to bring some things back to mind, brother Imam, but it's hard right now. But it warns us, this surah in the Quran warns us about patience and righteous deeds to get to this point in our life, you know. I can't get my words together right now, brother Imam. Excuse me.
That's okay. It'll come to you. We can ask Dr. El Hadid for his commentary on this reading.
Yes, sir.
Dr. El Hadid?
Yes, sir. First of all, you know, when you attempt to give some interpretation to Quran, it's always good to identify which city that you know the surah was revealed in, and this particular surah was revealed in Mecca, and so that gives you a clue right there as to where you know the language is going. So in Mecca, the main emphasis was on Tawheed, the oneness of Allah, and the main emphasis was on challenging the Quraysh, the Arabs who were in that city, to return to the religion of their great grandfather, Ibrahim alayhi salam. And so you always know that's sort of a general theme of those Meccan surahs.
Okay.
And you'll find a lot of those Meccan surahs. Yes.
Now, just for the benefit of our listening audience, I want to assume everyone knows Mecca, Medina. So, before you finish your statement, can you make a distinction between verses revealed to the Prophet while in the city of Mecca compared to verses revealed to him while in the city of Medina?
Yes, sure. If you look at the Quran is a book that is actually the voice of Allah speaking to the universe, speaking to the whole of humanity. And that voice is brought to our prophet by an angel. We call the angel Jibril, but the Bible is known as Gabriel. Or you might say the Holy Spirit. So the whole Quran is Allah talking to you, talking to humanity. Now, the revelations for our Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, peace and blessings be upon him, came initially in 610, a common era, in the holy city of Mecca. That's where he was born. And those revelations continued from 610 to 622, at which time then he migrated north to the city of Medina, which at that time was called Yathrib. And at that point, he established the first mosque. He also established the nation itself, you know, the early community. So the distinction between these two revelations is one is hammering homes, you know, stop, you know, worshiping idols, stop bearing girl babies, stop running around the Kaaba with no clothes on, you know. So he was speaking, you know, it was a strong language to the Quraysh themselves. Now, once the community formed and the pressure got so hard on the Prophet and his followers that they had to flee from Mecca to Medina, then at that point, the surahs relate more to how do you go about building a faith, family, and community. That turned to be the thing, you know, building the Ummah, you know. So this particular one is relating to faith and the oneness of Allah. And it's telling you, and when Allah said, well, us, in this point Allah is swearing by time. You know, when you say, well, that's example, you say, wallahi, you know, I swear by Allah. Well, us, I swear by time. You know, there's a number of surahs that, you know, you're swearing by something. It's not... In Islam, you know, swearing is not something that is sacrilegious, but you are appealing, and by God, the only one you can swear is by God, you know, swearing by time, swearing by God himself, you know. But you're doing it for emphasis, to wake people up.
Yes, sir.
And let them know there's a mighty word that's coming down, you know. And I agree with the translation you had about, that you should counsel the believers to be patient and constant. So I think that would be the main thing for me in terms of providing an audience with a context. You know, Martin Luther King, whenever he would deliver a sermon and take his text, he would always give you the setting or the located in some historical time period. So in this sense, the setting is in Mecca. He's talking primarily to his own people who were members of the Quraysh tribe and the clan of the Hashemites. And he was just warning them, let's return to the worship of God according to the way Abraham taught us. And I think our audience should know, too, that the Arabs themselves are from Abraham, but through the line of Hagar and Ishmael. And they all are Semitic people. But you also have other Semitic people who came through the line of Abraham and Sarah, and that's where the Jewish people came from. Our people came through the line, the Muslim lineage came through the line of Hagar, the Egyptian queen, and then through Ishmael, who was the son of Hagar, and then, of course, Isaac was the son of Sarah. So I think
that
should be helpful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you very much. Brother Mustafa, you ready? You ready for your comments?
No, sir, brother. Man, I think the email did a beautiful, wonderful job with that.
He did.
Brought some stuff to mind. Praise be to Allah.
Yes, you know, very good. You know, because this, we always begin our show with reading words from the Quran. We think it's only proper to have in heaven a show title Words Made People. But before we begin with our conversation, we should begin with the conversation or the words that is revealed to us by Almighty God, Allah, and that's the words of the Quran. I'd like to read some comments, too, that Imam Muhammad shared with us years ago about the importance of words and his comments on the phrase that he gave us, because he's the one who gave us the phrase. We know that. I just want to reiterate that he's the one that gave us the phrase, words made people. And I'm going to read a couple of statements from Imam Muhammad on the concept of words made people. And this is from a book he wrote when he first became a leader in 1975, right around 1975 or 76. The book was called The Wisdom of W.D. Muhammad. And he says, quote, in true scriptural language, words mean much more than spoken words. It means anything that gives a message to your mind. So God is speaking to you not only with words, but with all the objects in the physical creation. These messages that reach your mind are called the words of God. It is these words that form your mind and your personality. You are really a creation of words. Nothing can make a man or a woman but words. Human beings can be born again. All you have to do is allow yourself to be fed by a new kind of word, and that will make you come into a new person again. And I think that's quite fitting for our topic. I think that's going to work its way into our topic today. Dr. Derek King should be here in the next 10 minutes or so, and we really want to get into our conversation. Let me read just one more statement by Imam Muhammad on words. And this right here goes back to, this one here is 2007, which is toward the end of his time amongst us on earth. And he says, this is from, what date is this? It just says 2007. I'm not sure of the month. But he says, quote, if we could take the time, we could show you and bring you to agree with us that every person is formed, created, or made in the physical world by words, language. So the word brings a message to the mind. what do we mean by language? Look at the number one and the number two. You may not call them words, but in God's wisdom, I am writing words. These numbers are seen as words even in the wisdom of the wise of this world. A word is that which brings a message to your mind. A word is that which brings a message to your mind. Everything that I am doing is bringing a message to your mind. You don't call these quote-unquote words, but they are. What you're doing now is getting words. When the baby comes from the mother, their eyes open and the baby sees something when the eyes are open. Without a word being spoken to the child has received many words. The images that the child sees are words going into the mind of the child. Everything in your environment is words speaking to your mind, forming you in the body. The books you read, the language of your parents, the talk you heard in the home, the words you heard in the streets, the physical things that you looked at and thought about, the physical things that you looked at and didn't think about, all words. All these things have acted as words, gone into your mind, formed you, and they are forming you for as long as you live in the world. The process of making or forming human beings never stops. It goes on all the time. If you don't want yourself to be created in ill, bad, ugly, or diseased forms, you have got to get wise to the language of the environment and start selecting the things that you want to go into your mind. As some email W.D. Muhammad, another comment from him on words and how words make people. So, alhamdulillah, we will continue on with our show. I have great faith that Dr. King is going to be here very soon. Dr. El-Hadi, while we are waiting for Dr. King to come, can you spend a minute or two at the most? Give us a little background on yourself, who you are, your education, and some of your works that you are in, so that our listeners will have an idea of who you are and your qualifications.
Yes, sir. My name is Mary Al-Hadid, and I came into the fold of Islam, Nairobi, Kenya, in 1969, and shortly after that made the Hajj in 1970, and from that time to now, I've been consistently striving to stay on what we call the Sirat al-Mustaqim, you know, the straight way. I served as the founding chair of the Department of Africana Studies at Tennessee State University from 1994 to the time I retired in 2008. And inshallah ta'ala, they've asked me to come back and teach a course that we created called the Great Debate. And in that Great Debate, we look at the ideas of Dr. Martin Luther King, Haris Malik El-Shabazz of Malcolm X, and then John Coltrane, you know, the spirit of Train. And I collaborated on a book that serves as the master text for the Great Debate, and the book is called Between Cross and Crescent, Christian and Muslim Perspectives on Malcolm and Martin, and that with a Dr. King scholar by the name of Dr. Lewis B. Baldwin, who at the time was just collaborated the book with at Vanderbilt University, and he too has retired, and we are both just enjoying our retirement and just reflecting on our careers. And that's pretty much where I am at this point in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a question because I never thought of John Coltrane in the same sentence or breath with Dr. Martin Luther King and El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz for Malcolm X.
Yes.
What is the connection with John Coltrane with those two leaders?
Oh, excellent question. There's a concept that the Germans call the Zeitgeist, which is the spirit of the
Zeitgeist?
the zeitgeist.
Okay.
Z-E-I-T-G-I-S-T. And Dr. King used that phrase a lot, and it means the spirit of the times or the spirit of history. And as you know, in the 60s, we used to say, we're going to do what the spirits say do. There was something in the air, there was something that was moving you to join a movement or stand up or have pride. Even today, there's a zeitgeist taking place in our community. I guess the best way to describe it is Black Lives Matter. And we're pushing back against police brutality. We're pushing back against injustice. We are pushing back against the harmful things that we're currently doing to each other, you know, in the inner cities and in our families, you know. So there's a spirit constantly moving and animating history, you know. So and so in a certain way, when you listen to the music of John Coltrane, especially his greatest composition called A Love Supreme, and you read the liner notes, which is a poem in that Love Supreme, you can actually see how he's trying to, in a certain way, synthesize all of the wisdom of the East, the wisdom of the West in terms of the philosophies and religious systems. And so I see Coltrane as a synthesis of the idea of Dr. King and the idea or philosophy of Brother Malcolm. So if you think about Islam, for example, the essence of Islam is peace. The essence of Christianity is love. And the essence of Judaism is justice. Okay? So as Coltrane is pulling all this together, now it's hard to sort of translate it because he wasn't using words, he was using music. But when you listen carefully to Coltrane's music, especially after he had his epiphany and started doing spiritual type music, you know, before that he was doing bebop with Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk and so forth. But after he decided that he was going to change his life, he went through a spiritual conversion, pretty much the way we went through our conversion, converting to Islam, converting to Christianity. You know, he was a drug addict, and he was also addicted to alcohol. In fact, he died of sclerosis of the liver. But toward a period in his life, say around, roughly around 1965, right in that period, which, as you know, was a very critical period in our movement. And he underwent this spiritual conversion, and from that point on, he got into yoga, started practicing yoga. He had a guru, and he used the method of yoga in order to develop himself.
Right.
Sometimes you might notice in some of his music, he was able to play a long time. Sometimes he would play for like 20 minutes, and it seems though he wasn't taking any breath. So he was using yoga breathing techniques in order to keep his music going.
Yeah, circular breathing.
Roshan Roland Kirk did the same thing, you know. So there were a number of jazz musicians who were into yoga. And Dizzy Gillespie was into yoga as well. And they also had a certain jazz musician that was into the Ahmadiyya movement who became Muslim, like McCoy Tyner, Ahmadiyya Mall, and people, you know. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well,
thank you. I think, yes, it does, because it was very interesting to see the connection that you made with Dr. King and Malcolm X with John Coltrane.
Yeah.
I think we have with us here our brother, Dr. Derek King. Are you with us?
I'm with you, brother.
Yes, sir. Welcome to Words Made People.
Blessings. Glad to be here.
Yes, sir. So, yeah, we just had Dr. Amiri Al-Hadi. He just gave a little brief bio of himself, and we'd like for you to do the same, if you so please, before we get into our conversation. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Derek King.
Well, I'm the third child, born to A.D. and Naomi King. Born and reared in the South, professionally. I've pastored for 12 years in the Baptist faith, missionary Baptist faith. In 1999, I was given an opportunity to come to serve as an instructor at Martin University here in Indianapolis, Indiana. The founder, Father Hardin, gave me opportunity to come serve in Martin. So I've been at Martin University since 2001, and joys of my life to pour into people and watch these priceless flowers bloom. So I'm just glad to I have and I do a little bit of travel around the country as a activist and a motivator. So I think that'll put me in a nutshell.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Yeah, we appreciate that. So let's get into our conversation, and I'm going to try and set the groundwork for the conversation, because we're here to help each other, edify each other, and to grow. Now, the topic can be somewhat sensitive because it can be misunderstood, or someone makes it, well, where are they trying to come from? You know, what is the focus for this conversation? But I think it's important that we have it, the talk on how enslaved Africans became Christians. And I'm pausing there for a minute, because that would be like part one of our conversation. Just how did enslaved Africans become Christians? I think that in itself is full of rich history that's not very much, at least commonly, talked about. You know, they show Africans being captured or landing on the shores of the Americas, beginning in Brazil, the islands, on up to North America. And then there's this thing called slavery that goes on for eons, for 300 to 400 years. And then here we are fighting for civil rights. But somewhere along the line, that there was some transferring done in belief systems. We adopted certain beliefs or belief systems. And this is just to have a look at that pathway, that journey, if you will, that was taken by what essentially is a new people on earth. And because when they capture Africans, from a number of places, when we landed here on the shores of North America, you know, you can say that you're from Ghana or Nigeria or Senegal, but when the pains of slavery or pains of that slave whip hit the back, it didn't care if you were from Ghana or Sierra Leone or whatever. So we came from diverse backgrounds in Africa with various beliefs, belief systems and values, traditions, and which was pretty much either watered down, if not outright lost, when we landed here in America. Often lost because the next generation, if you were taking it from your parents, they could not pass on to you the values that they had with them. And then centuries passed by along the way. So that I guess I want to begin reading just one more statement, and then we can begin our conversation. Let me get it right. I have my statement here. Yes. Okay. Well, it goes that we know that many people have. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. The development and the preservation of Bible texts. And this is not a criticism of the Bible. We're just looking at the history of it. The development and preservation of Bible texts and its numerous translations covered the Dark Ages, the European Dark Ages, then the European Dark Ages went into the Renaissance, or some say the Renaissance. And included in this travel of this pathway, the Bible goes through the King James alterations, or King James version, and there were other versions as well. And then also you had the influence of Martin Luther along the way. Then you had another phase called the Age of Enlightenment, to where the European experience was beginning to question things and coming to an Age of Enlightenment, which, you know, led to the founding of America to where we are now. So when we take this and much more, that is the pathway of the Bible development that speaks of the understanding from, which is really by and large a Eurocentric pathway or Eurocentric history and perspective. And so the first question I wanted to ask our two guests, all that I mentioned, the Dark Ages, the Renaissance, Martin Luther, Rebellion, if you will, the King James translations and versions, all this coming up to the Age of Enlightenment to where we are now. That is a Eurocentric pathway of Christianity. Is that trajectory or that pathway suitable for African Americans? I'd like to first ask that question to Dr. Derek King, that pathway, that travel. Is
well,
it suitable for African Americans?
I don't know if I wouldn't. I can't resonate with the word suitable. I would say for me, in your discourse, there's one thing that we don't pay a lot of attention to is how the Bible came to be this compilation of these 66 books. There's one thing we have to give attention to. The scholarship suggests that it took 1,500 years to come up with what we call the King James Bible, the 66 canonized compositions that make up the Bible. It's suitable. To me, I think it's a matter of in 2017, those people who walked the way of Christ, who used the King James Holy Bible as their sacred text, it's a matter of what meets their faith needs. So I wouldn't say suitable is what meets a person's faith needs. One other thing I was thinking about, one statement I was going to make. In America, we have something granted to every citizen by way of the Bill of Rights, religious freedom. Whatever fits your need then becomes acceptable to the believer, not suitable, acceptable.
Okay. And thank you very much, Dr. El Hadid.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
The chronology, you know, that you laid out does provide us with a framework, because see, history is the property of the human community, human family. And sometimes, certain groups are in charge and sometimes they're, subjugated. At this particular time in the history of the world, we as African American, as Africans, are in a subordinate position. We're either experiencing neocolonialism on the continent, and we're experiencing, white supremacy or racism in the diaspora. But I would like to approach it from this standpoint. When we let's take that period that you call the Dark Ages, I think your audience should be aware that the darkness was in Europe. It wasn't in Africa, Asia Minor, and Asia. There was no Dark Ages at that time in China. There was
nor North America.
Right. So Europe was in the dark. The lights had gone out in Europe. Right. And then when they came out through the Renaissance, well, let's look at how the lights went out. Well, you know, the Western Europeans developed through the Greek Empire and then the Roman Empire, okay? And then when Islam, and they had come to dominate North Africa, Asia Minor, and so forth, and Europe. That was, you're talking primarily about the Roman Catholics. And when 600 years after Christ, when Islam came out of Arabia and started going into North Africa, it drove Christianity back into Europe. And then when the Ottomans came out on the east side, you know, it drove them in. So you had the Christians, European Christians, now, let me qualify what I'm talking about, European Christians. I'm not talking about the Christians that were in Ethiopia, the Coptics, or the Christians that were in, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and you had the Coptics in Egypt, who had Christianity before the Romans got it or before Catholicism. So when Islam came, it drove King Christians back deeper into Europe. The Moors went into Spain in 711 and stayed there almost 800 years, but not pushed out until 1492. And then the Ottomans on the east side, you know, in areas like Yugoslavia and the Balkans and so forth, they weren't pushed out until the end of the First World War in 1914. So they were, you know, and the whole language used you in the first resurrection, the word Europe, we call it Europe. They were roped up. They were bottled up on the northern side of the Mediterranean, okay? So they needed that Renaissance so they could go back to the Greco-Roman tradition, and they could go back. At that time, only most of the people in Europe couldn't read and write. Only 5% of the people could read and write. And it was primarily the people who were connected with the religious institution,
right,
or the royal families. The vast majority of people couldn't read and write, you know?
Let me ask a question on that point. Let me ask a question, if I may, on that point, because I don't want to go too far down one pathline or another, but keeping essential or germane to our topic. The pathway of the journey, for the sacred text that we know as Bible we have now.
Right.
How did it travel through what you just described? Because that's pretty much what became dominant here in the Americas with the colonial period on into the making of the USA. How did that history shape? Because you mentioned that only the learner could read, so that tells me one thing. But how did that pathway shape not just the Bible but the understanding? Because keep in mind, we want to get to the point to when African Americans were allowed to put their hands and their minds on their book. But right now, just going through the history, how did it develop? So what kind of influence would that have had upon the text itself?
Well, you know, you had a lot of revisions of the Bible. Because, see, at first, Christianity was proselytized by the Catholics. And they had their own catechism, their own narrative. And then, of course, when they went into the Nicene Conference and came out, it was something totally different than what Christ was talking about. When the Romans and the fourth century, and Constantine became, at first they were persecuting the Christians and killing them. And then when Constantine became a Christian, it changed the whole narrative, you know. So then it became okay to be a Christian. And they went into the Nicene Conference, and they decided what the catechism was going to look like, what the beliefs were going to be all about, and so forth. And so now you're talking about a Christianity that was basically created by Constantine, and one that was also advanced by Paul more so than Christ. So if you look if you read a book like, for example, the book Jesus and the Disinherited, okay, by Howard Thurman, you know, he starts with the major premise that Jesus was a Jew. So when you start talking about appropriating Christianity, you got to go from the Old Testament going forward from that understanding, you know. But it's a change to a great extent based on, you know, the politics, the political situation.
Yes. Let me get Dr. King in here on get his thoughts.
Let me interject, and Dr. Al Habib is on point. What I want to go back to was the point you made about basically world literacy. It took a couple hundred years for people to become literate to the point where they could read and write, but there was one invention that impacted world literacy, in my opinion, was the invention of the printing press. For a long time, instruction, as Dr. El Hadid stated, it was I don't know if it was a privilege, but it was confined. But once the printing press was invented and published documents were disseminated, people became in learning how to read and write. Now, with the Bible, it's like this. I use this analogy. The origins of Christianity, as we know it, was in the Middle East, Palestine. So it's like if you line up 10 people, tell the first one to pass this message on. By the time it gets back to the originator of the message, it could have gone in so many different directions. So the journey, as you say, Imam Sahib, Imam Sahir, the journey has been we could, and Dr. Al-Hadid gave us a pathway that how it got to the Americas and on the plantation. But look at all of the geography. The tenets of Christ traveled. So my simple point is, talk about the journey, but we got to look at the terrain that the journey covered. So,
okay. And I just wanted to mention that first. I think it's important. I think I know it's important to set this groundwork first, because we wanted to get into when and how was the religious text put into the hands and also into the minds of our foreparents. And, you know, that's very important because, you know, and depending upon where you were within the continental USA, I know in Virginia they had laws just for slaves, and that in that part of the country, this is before 1776, this is about 90 years before, Virginia passed a law that you could not enslave a Christian, you know, so that, and that tells us a lot about the Africans that came to America and they were enslaved and came to America, that if they found out, and they obeyed the rule, of course, if they found out that this African was Christian, they, by law, could not enslave them. Dr. King, I begin with you. Can you give us some comments on that law? It's from 1667 from the state of Virginia. I don't want to read the law verbatim, but that's the essence of it.
Well, it kind of humored me when you put that question to me. The same mindset that crafted that law. You got to remember, when you're talking Virginia, you're talking about Thomas Jefferson and his papers. And I won't say some people fail to remember that the first attempt to in America to get to create an economy based on what came out of a ground in America, the first people that they had working in a plantation context were their own people.
That's right.
They tried to indenture their own people. So the second thing that happened, in my humble opinion, that manipulation, if you can't enslave it, you can't enslave a Christian. I don't think they wanted to apply that to Africans. I think it's for their own people.
Good point.
So, of course, they never, and you got to remember, in the mind of Thomas Jefferson and what they call the founding fathers, Africans were not full human beings. So I think the law applied to their own people.
Okay, very good point. Very good point. But then there was another law that came too. During that time period that spoke specifically and said if they were Indian or if they were Muslim, you know, or if they were people that practiced their traditional African religion, they could be enslaved. But if they were found to be Christian or their parents came from a Christian background, they could not. That was more specific. And I grant you what you just said. This 1667 law could have been referring to the Europeans who were called indentured servants. I think they'd done like a 7-year term. But there were other laws that came along that said plainly, and they named them by name as Indians. And I think they used the word Mohammedans, but that means Muslims. And they also said and Africans who practice traditional religion. Dr. El-Hadi, can you give us comments on that, please?
You want to know about the law, or what are you asking?
Yes, about the law, its meaning, and its application. Because Dr. King done a very good job on saying this first law here was really speaking, and it makes sense. His life to make sense. It may have been pointing more towards those Europeans that were indentured servants.
Yes.
Go ahead.
What I would say, to give you some context, as practitioners of our religions, our respective religions, we all know and perhaps will agree that there's sometimes a contradiction between creed and deed, between what people believe and what they practice, you know. Now, in terms of the African that were brought to basically the four corners of the earth. You know, we have to look at the whole globe and not just, you know, the ones that came across the Atlantic Ocean. There were people that were taken from Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, taken across the Red Sea and taken into Arabia, taken into India, and as far as China, you know. In terms of this whole African diaspora, you know, is a big situation. And you had a lot of countries that were involved. The initial ones were Spain and Portugal. Now, the Pope did this. The Pope issued a papal bull, and he divided the whole known world into the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere. He gave the Western Hemisphere to Spain, and the Eastern Hemisphere he gave to Portugal. Okay? So they were the explorers, and they go out and establish land. But the point I want to make, when you look at the Africans that came over here, and who came primarily from West Africa and Central Africa. Now, what was the characteristic of West and Central Africa? At that particular time, there were only two dominant religions being practiced in West and Central Africa. That was Islam and traditional African religions. Christianity did not become a phenomenon in that part of the world until the colonial period, which started with the Berlin Conference of 1884-1885. Interesting enough, once the colonial period started in Africa, that's pretty much around the same period as the Great Awakening over here, when they started bringing a lot of African slaves, you know, into Christianity. You know, you're talking roughly around the 19th century, okay? So it was a long time before Africans, either on the continent or in the diaspora, were really proselytized and brought, you know, into Christianity. Because you had, the way they sort of justified the thing, as the good Reverend Doctor was saying, Reverend Dr. King was saying, is that they came up with all kind of, you know, interpretations of the Bible going all the way back to, say, what you call the curse of Ham and the curse of Canaan. So first of all, they justified the fact that these people had a curse on them. So whatever you did to them was okay. They were doomed. They were cursed to be jars of water, you know, to be servants of Europeans, you know, jars of water.
Let me ask the question.
That was their destiny.
Where
what you did to them.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. When in large numbers were the Africans who were now slaves in America, when in large numbers were they first allowed to be open Christians? I mean, Dr. King, do you have any timeline on that to where, because it sounds like for a while the enslaved Africans were not allowed to be Christian, but then somewhere along the line they shifted.
I would say, and again, in my opinion, as some research suggests, it took about five generations before Africans started to embrace the idea of Christianity.
Now, these are Africans in America, right? These are Africans.
Africans in America. Africans
correct.
In America.
Okay.
About five generations. Early on, the African idea, the enslaved African idea of Christianity, they called it book religion. They couldn't read, couldn't write. They were starting to understand the English language. So there was a language barrier for generations before Africans could even entertain the idea of Christianity. So I'd say early 1500s, in my opinion, early 1500s.
Early 1500s, wait a minute, the slavery, 1500s or 1700s? Because 1500s, you're going back before.
Some people, again, there's variance in scholarship. Some people say the slave trade started as early as 1400. So,
right.
So that's why I'm on research that I've done. I'm saying still. I still say mid 1500s to entertain the idea of Christianity. Because they never intended to give the African the idea of the full biblical drama. Because one thing they didn't want the African to know is about the Exodus the Exodus event in the history of the Jews. If they had discovered that this God who delivered Israel, if this God you want me to believe in, if he delivered Israel, he can deliver us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Dr. El-Hadi, do you have a time period in your studies as to when African Americans in groups in Marseille became Christians, I mean practicing Christians?
Well, you know, I think what would be useful for our discussion is this, that the two groups that came over were either practitioners of their African religions, I'm using that in the plural, because, take example, mm-hmm. if you were Igbo and someone else was a Yoruba, you had different religions. It was almost like different denominations of African religions. Like we have different denominations, right? Igbos
okay.
and Yorubas didn't practice the same traditional religion. Now, on the other hand, if you were a Muslim and came over, whether you were Yoruba or Mandinka, you practiced the same religion. So you had Muslims that came over and you have a lot of Muslims that came over. I would say some scholars say that maybe some would say as low as 5%, some would say as high as 20 or 25%. And the obvious reason for that is that the Muslims were a part of empires. They had militaries. So they had armies. They could fight back against slave traders, right? And they were pretty much inside of the Sahara Desert. The people that they brought over were in the forest, you know, the people that were the farmers and had not formed military states to protect themselves. So they were easy prey for slave raiders who came into the area and so forth. Now, another thing I think that we need to understand, too, is before we get to the conversion part, what did Africans believe before they were converted to either Christianity or Islam? We have to get to that. So then that gives you some idea of what really happened in the conversion process. But let me give you a synopsis of that. Africans basically believe in a religion that describes through the living, the dead, and the unborn. And we're talking about their cosmology now. So when they spoke of community and extended family, they included in that extended family, in that community, people that were living in the present, people that were ancestors in the past, and people who were to come in the future. You see what I'm saying? So then they also believed, they didn't believe in the private ownership of property because the property, the land, belongs to the ancestors. So they had a communal, you know, way of life. And then they also believed in, say, for example, in let's take two things. In Christianity, we might say that in order to get to God, you have to go through the Son, you know, that appealing to Christ. Christ becomes an advocate for you, an intermediate for you to get to God. Now, in the traditional African way of thinking, it was not a Christ, but it was the ancestors. So that when you poured libations or you did an animal sacrifice, you were sacrificing to your grandmother or your grandfather, your uncle, somebody who was on the other side. And your ancestors were the ones that spoke to the supreme being. So, for example, if you were Yoruba, then the ancestor would speak to Odumare. Okay? Now, if you follow that cosmology, when the Africans were introduced to Christianity, they were not strangers to animal sacrifice. They were doing that to their ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
They were not strangers to libations, so they could understand baptism. You follow what I'm saying? And so when they were brought into Christianity, whether it was Catholics or Protestants, they practiced Christianity the way they understood it in the context of their own religion. Okay?
Let me ask you one question on that. Because Dr. King made a good point that there were generations that caused a severance, a break between even knowing what was the African tradition. There was no
right.
one generation transfer, that there were plus the families being split and torn apart, there was no transferal of the African tradition to popular religion today. But and also we do have a caller on hold too. I want to get to my caller. Go ahead, please, Dr. El Hadid.
Yeah, but see, what you have to realize, I agree in one way, but think about this. That would be true if you're talking about the people that were born on the plantation and didn't have the collective memory.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that they brought over here were adults or teenagers. So when they came over here, that they had knowledge of their culture and their ancestors. And then when they were brought into Christianity, you can really clearly see it when you go to South America, like in the Caribbean. What they would do, for example, they had, they would pour libations to their ancestors. You know, they had saints. So when they were brought into Catholicism, that had a system of saints. The Catholics might think that they were worshiping Saint Mark or they were worshiping Saint whomever, but they were actually worshiping one of their own deities. And basically what I'm saying, they were Christians by day and voodoo by night. Proof of which is when you go down to places like New Orleans or South Carolina, and especially when you go out to south, like when you go to Cuba or you go to Brazil, they practice their traditional religion. Some of them might call Candomblé in Brazil or Santa Maria in Cuba. They practice their traditional religion right alongside of Catholicism. And African Americans do the same thing in with Protestant religion, mainly like in places like South Carolina among the Gullah. Now, when you go to Mobile and Louisiana, which is mainly Catholics, then they're practicing pretty much like the people in Cuba or the people in Brazil. See, it was the Catholics and the French that brought Catholicism into America. The Germans, the English, and some of these others brought brought the Protestantism in. America was sort of set up the way they wanted to believe as a WASP culture, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You know what I'm saying? So there were always discrimination against Catholics. Kennedy was the only Catholic president they had. He didn't last. You know what I mean? That kind of scenario. I hope, I know I'm talking real fast because I want to get a lot of information in, but I hope that will give some idea,
Yes, sir. It makes sense. Yes, it does make sense. Mm-hmm. Let me get my caller. They've been patient. And we do want to encourage our other listeners, if you have a call, if you have a question, you want to call in, please, if you have called in, just press 1 on your phone and we can try to work your question and hopefully brief comment into our conversation. Our first caller here is from Indianapolis from 317. Can you, caller, please give us your first name and your city? Well, I know your city because you're calling from my city of Indianapolis.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Brother Muhammad Sadiq calling.
Yes, sir.
I just want to ask a question. I mean, this rich history that I'm hearing shared, and I'm probably addressing this more to Dr. King than anybody else, and not to Dr. King, the individual, but Dr. King, who would be a representative of the Christian faith. Why is it? How can you, the representative, be so wealthy and rich and clear in this wisdom, and yet the great majority of our Christian brothers and sisters either are devoid of this or have not shared in this or have not reacted to this? Because I believe if this kind of insight would be put into action, it would make a change in our whole society, in the thinking and in the consequences of the crime, overwhelming crime. And I'm not trying to ask you, Dr. King, to take the responsibility of it. I mean, but I'm really saying it as a positive compliment to you. How do you get it from you to them and get it from them as a philosophy into action so that we can change this, the direction? of our community. I mean, it's so beautiful to hear this wonderful conversation, except when you reflect on the fact that why has not the majority of these people who are Christian brothers and sisters been able to react to this large segment of history, and they're focused on one little narrow idea of the Christian faith, and not this history that I think could change the whole direction of the Christian faith.
Well, I take a stab at it. What I say, what I'm saying over the air, I've said it consistently over the years.
You've done your work.
No.
I'm saying it as a spokesperson only.
No. Let me get there, Muhammad. Let me get there.
Okay.
I've said this in classrooms in Martin University for 16 years.
Yes,
Christians have taken Christ in the majority of community of Christians. The message of Christ has not been promoted. Christianity, the biggest failure of Christianity in America, in my opinion, is something that was written in the Constitution. And the first amendment in the Bill of Rights, religious freedom. That's the problem. Christians are too free. Too free. Free to do whatever you want to do. Too free. The message of Christ has not been since the we have had the content of Christianity like we had it in the Civil Rights Movement. We don't hear a lot of Christian pastors, teachers advocating the message of liberation that comes from the gospel. The message of love that comes from the gospel. The message of justice that comes from the gospel. Christian pastors, a bunch of them, have missed the message of Christ. It's get what God got for you now. The money is coming, but what about loving your neighbor, loving your enemy? Build big buildings, fly around the country in jets, but what about am I my brother's keeper? So my effort is I use this analogy. Every flood starts with a raindrop.
Yes.
Every blizzard starts with a snowflake. Every cyclone, hurricane, typhoon, tornado starts with a gust of wind. I'm just trying to get snowflakes to hook up. Raindrops to hook up, wind to harness. If I can just get one to do what Jesus said do, and get that one to try to find somebody else who wants to do what Jesus said do, we will start seeing the change. So that's where I'm at.
Well, I appreciate where you are. I just want to help some others get there too. I really appreciate where
and
you are.
And the other thing, I appreciate Imam Sahir for trying to get the mosque and the sanctuary to start having more conversation.
Yeah.
I think some people have said that this is. Some people have said it before. We might have come on different boats, but we're on the same show now. We got to get this thing together.
Yes, sir.
There you go. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you so very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it. And keep up the excellent
yes,
work.
Yes, sir.
Both of you. Keep
yes,
it up.
Sir.
Very impressive
yes, sir.
Dialogue.
Yes, yeah, thank you for calling in and supporting Works Made People. We have another caller here, since we can get into our callers now. Calling from 847 area code. Call us from 847. Can you give us your first name and your city, please? Caller from the 847 area code. Okay. and maybe we'll come back to them. Maybe they didn't know they pushed one on the phone. Caller 847. Okay. Okay, let's continue on. We got about, our time is going a lot faster than I thought. I have a question I want to present here, and it's along the line of scholarship. Okay. I begin with Dr. El Hadid. The growth and the evolvement of Islam within the African-American experience that is different, we know, from that of Christianity. Christianity came to us in Marseilles in the 1800s on the plantation and really thereafter. It was the choice we had, was one form or another of Christianity. But Dr. El Hadid, can you speak on how Islam came to be a influence or a factor within the African American experience?
Oh, yes, sir. Islam came into our continent in the 7th century, and it traveled across North Africa, went up into Spain, and germinated there for almost 800 years, and then you know, we were talking earlier about the period of the slave trade. Some people would take it back as early as 1444. There's an interesting book we all might want to read called Capitalism and Slavery by Eric Williams, a scholar from
It's called what now?
Say that again.
Capitalism and Slavery.
Capitalism.
Capitalism and Slavery by Eric Williams.
Okay.
And he lays down, you know, some historiography, but he's looking at it more or less from an economic standpoint. He's talking about the triangular trade. Now, his date goes back to 1444, which is before, you know, the Moors were pushed out of Spain. The Moors were the Muslims. Now, and then once, some scholars would say that once the Moors were pushed out of Spain, that's the point at which the transatlantic slave trade really started in earnest. Now, you got two different ideas here. Now, well, if you read some of the black nationalists like Dr. Ben or Dr. Clark, they would make the argument is that when the Moors came out of Spain, there were two types of Moors. One, you had Arabs who were part of the Umayyad dynasty, or some were also a part of the Abbasid that went into Spain. And then, of course, you had the Berbers, who from North Africa, you had the Berber Moors and you had the Arab Moors. And Shakespeare sort of talks about them in his play, Othello. But the point I want to make here is that Clark would have you to believe that when the Moors were pushed back into Spain by the union of those two families, Castile and Aragon, and Shakespeare also plays that out in Romeo and Juliet, in terms of these two families who have been fighting each other. That's why the Moors were able to gain a stronghold in Moorish Spain. But what he would argue is that when the Spanish and the French got together and pushed the Moors out of Spain, the Moors went into the slave trade. So now you had Arab and Berber Muslims joining Spanish and Portuguese Christians in the interior of Africa and taking people to the coast, whether it was taken to the coast of Senegal, taken to the coast of Gambia. I mean, these are the arguments they are making, right, from the way they're reading things, right? But the point I want to make here is that regardless of how that slave trade went down, because there's a mess of guilt to go around, because you also have, you know, we might, for example, celebrate in 1324, we talk about how Mansa Musa went on his pilgrimage to Mecca, and he took so much gold with him. But he also took 2,000 slaves. We don't talk about that. Are you with me? So we need to bring some attention to that. And he took 2,000 slaves across the Sahara Desert, across the Red Sea, and into Arabia. So who bought those slaves that Mansa Musa took over there? Who bought the slaves in Cairo when Mansa Musa got there, right? So we need to look at that. and as a Muslim, I refuse to be an apologist. I mean, for slavery, regardless of who's doing it, in the name of which religion.
Right.
Now, that needs to be brought out. And see, that was one of the problems we had in the 60s. In the 60s, what the Muslims were doing, we were attacking African-American Christians, telling them that they had the slave master's religion, which was true, that they had slave names, which was true, right, and that they used to surrender the slave master's name, the slave master's religion, and then they should come into Islam, right? Now, what we didn't know about, as Muslims who were criticizing African-American Christians, we didn't know about the East African slave trade, and if we did, we didn't talk about it. We didn't know about the Trans-Saharan slave trade. If we did, we didn't talk about it, right? So when you talk about the slave trade, don't limit ourselves to the transatlantic slave trade. Let's talk about all of it. Let's talk about the Trans-Saharan slave trade. Let's talk about the East African slave, because there was slave trade going on all along that East Coast, in places like Somalia and Ethiopia, and all the way down from South Africa all the way up to Egypt, along that coast of the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. There was slave trade going on. You had people that were going inside of Central Africa, back in places like the Congo, coming out of Mozambique, going there. I mean, they were pushing all the way over to Namibia. And some of those slaves that were taken from places like Namibia and Angola, they were taken over by the Portuguese, to Brazil. So we need to look at all of that now. Not that we have to get bogged down with it, but let's just put all the historical facts on the table. Now let's come to how we came into Islam. Now, like I was saying earlier, the vast majority of the people that are brought up here were not Muslims, even though we were told that in the 60s, that our original religion was Islam, our original language was, where I'm going with that. So, but the truth of the matter is, only about 20% of the people that came over here were Muslims. And the rest of them were practicing Zulu. So what happened, because there were so few Muslims, it was fairly easy for Islam not to become a reckoning force. But let's look at the history of some of the people that came. You had people that were hafiz of Quran, who were scholars, like Abdurrahman, Omar Said, you can name them. They were treated, once the slave masters found out they were Muslims, they didn't treat them the same way they treated the people that were practicing voodoo, because they had more in common. In other words, the people who were Muslims were also practitioners of monotheism. They believed in Jesus already, so they didn't have to convert them to Jesus. They didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, but they believed that Jesus was a prophet. You follow what I'm saying? And so a lot of these people were also... So they treated them a little differently. And when you study the history, like Austin's book on Muslims in Antebellum America, they were given positions of leadership and authority. Sometimes they were put in positions where they were in charge of 500 slaves. And they didn't treat them the same way the overseer treated them. They treated them with humanity. Because see, slavery already existed in Africa. It was pretty much like what they had in the 13 colonies with the whites. People were indentured. They were not chattel. So that the Muslims who were given positions of leadership and authority, they were just, they were compassionate, they were humane. They didn't abuse people, And so, after that, then eventually, some people started talking about Islam. The first people to show up, I would say, would be Nobu Drew Ali, with the Murder Science Temple. Then after Nobu Drew Ali, then Farad Muhammad came in 1930, and then, of course, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad followed him, Ahmadiyyas were on the scene, too. Ahmadiyyas were on the scene as early as the 1930s, maybe. And then you also had the State Street Mosque in New York. So, and then, as I mentioned earlier, many of the jazz musicians, like Ahmad Jamal and McCoy Tyner, and Decatur State, and these people were members of the Ahmadiyya movement. So you had people who were practicing, if you will, Sunni Islam during those early periods, like the 1950s and 1940s. A lot of those beboppers in the bebop era were members of the Ahmadiyya movement. They were Muslims.
Okay. So what you're saying, so we can, if I'm hearing you right, that this is post-slavery. The early 1900s, 2030s in particular, you got a movement that came into the United States to, and as it was given to reconnect you to your original religion. That's another conversation. But there was a introduction to the African American thinking of Islam as being the religion for you. But if I can, I want to use that to segue. But I want to make sure I heard you right. But I want to segue upon that and introduce and ask Dr. King, well, both of you, to make comments on Dr. Howard Thurman and his meeting with Gandhi. This is back, I had the year, I want to say it was the early 30s, maybe, or the 40s. And when Gandhi, when Howard Thurman traveled with a group of Christians over to India, when India was part of a travel, Howard Thurman had a conversation with Gandhi, and Gandhi asked Howard Thurman the question, why did Americans, well, they have Negroes in this report, why did American Negroes remain Christian? Why not turn to Islam, in which all are brothers? And keep in mind that Gandhi, he wasn't Muslim, he was a Hindu. But he challenged Thurman with that question. And before Dr. King responded, I want to emphasize that Thurman was one of the men, he was a contemporary with Dr. King Sr., Martin Luther King's father, which is also, I guess, Derrick King's grandfather, Derrick King being the nephew of Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King. But Thurman, who was one of the teachers of Dr. King, was questioned by Gandhi as to why are African Americans not turning to Islam. And then the part of the debate was that in the end, that when Dr. Thurman said he preferred to remain Christian, then Gandhi told Dr. King, well, then at least go back and use Christianity as a way to address racism and the other problems that African Americans were facing. Dr. King, you have any comment you'd like to share on what you know about that meeting and the outcome?
Well, I'm not a Howard Thurman scholar, but one of the things that happened with Dr. Thurman, as is the case with most, the majority of black people in America, Christianity was the dominant religion tried to, and I use this word cautiously, tried to evangelize Africa, I mean black folks in America. Dr. Thurman started out as a denominational affiliate, but somewhere in his journey, he abandoned denominationalism. And in some circles of conversation, Dr. Thurman was a pioneer in spiritualist movement in America. And that's where my conversations, I met Dr. Thurman on one occasion, and that's when I got intrigued and started to read his writings. But to answer the question of why he didn't challenge black people to abandon Christianity, that one I can't address.
Yes, sir. Okay. Dr. El Hadi, you have any thoughts on this question here? The one I just posed?
Yes, I've read that passage. I can't remember which book it was. But the context, I think, what happened, Howard Thurman went with a delegation of people, and I think it was in the 1930s. It had to have been because he was assassinated in 1948, somewhere around that, shortly after independence came to India. It was probably in the 1930s, at the most, the early 1940s. So he had that conversation with Howard Thurman, and he was talking about how that Islam would help African Americans to have a different mentality, you know, rather than being docile and subordinate like they had been conditioned to be under slavery. So that was, as I remember, that was sort of the tenor of the conversation. But I would say this, though. If you look at Christianity in terms of how our leaders responded to that effort by missionaries and owners of slaves to collectively pull texts out of the Bible to make us docile, what happened, it went in the opposite direction. You remember that Nat Turner was a preacher. But he had a different understanding of Christianity. John Brown was a Christian, but he had a different understanding of Christianity. You know what I'm saying? So you can go all the way back, you know, to a number of people who were Christians during Reconstruction. Harry Tubman was a Christian. Frederick Douglass was a Christian. Martin Delaney was a Christian. But they were literate. And they started, as the good doctor was saying early, they started to connect teachings of Christianity back to the Exodus. And that's what Howard Thurman is talking about in his book, Jesus and the Disinherited.
Yeah.
So once you start connecting Christianity with the Old Testament, the party is over in terms of being docile. And that's one of the things that slave master taught. Keep them in the New Testament. Keep them in the fifth chapter of Matthew, where you're supposed to turn the other cheek. You know what I mean? But once you take them into the Old Testament, where they're talking about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, I mean, even just take them into the Ten Commandments, and you know what I mean? It's a whole different, you know, scenario. So you can't divorce the Torah from Christianity. Some people try to do it. And once you take the Old Testament out of Christianity, you've messed up the whole narrative. Because it's one dispensation, you know, from Adam, and then from Adam to Noah, and from Noah, let's say, down to Abraham, from Abraham down to Moses, from Moses to Jesus, from Jesus to Muhammad. It was just one story. But once you start dividing, okay, the Old Testament is for Jews, and the New Testament is for Christians, and the Quran is for the Muslims, you mess up the whole dispensation. You mess up the whole idea. The God sent one word, a mighty word, you know. And then my parting point is this. You know, when you start talking about what Christianity is really all about, what God meant, it says it's clear in the Bible. The whole essence of the whole story is love God with all that might and with all that soul and that neighbor as yourself. I don't care what your religion is. You're Muslim, a Hindu, or Christian. Once you get that, you don't need anything else.
Yeah, so if I can, I think Dr. King wanted to do a follow up. Dr. King got a follow up. Wait a minute. Well, we're not follow up, but he got something he wants to say, and I have a caller on hold, and we got about 3 minutes to do something.
I'm gonna make this point real quick. The domination.
Don't go too quick now. We mess it up.
Okay. The domination of the Catholic Church in global affairs, going back to its inception, is undeniable. But a key factor, in my opinion, of the image, even the imaging of Jesus in the mind of a lot of black folks in America, goes back to something that happened in the Sistine Chapel when Michelangelo started to paint the mural. He was painting the biblical characters in their he was painting them in the culture from which they came. See, though, you got to remember, if we're going to tell the truth about the origins of Christianity, it's on Africa, the continent of Africa, where Michelangelo painted all of the biblical characters white. One thing people got to remember, that the Old Testament characters, if we're going to tell the truth about them, they were, the politically correct term is, they were people of color. But the Catholic Church made made the Old Testament characters all the way through the New Testament characters, made them all white. So,
and that's true also with the TV, with Hollywood movies. Yeah, so, but your point is valid. Yes, it's very valid. The whole conversation has been very valid. I'd like to get my caller in. This is my brother from Los Angeles, California. A caller from L.A. Can you give us your first name, please, and your question, comment?
Yeah, Yes. This is Amin.
Yes,
this is Amin from Los Angeles. You know, I wrote a book called Afrocentricity Minus Al-Islam Cheats. That's the time to address the denigration of Islam by Dr. Ben and John Henry Clark and Chancellor Williams and Malefi Asante and all those who were on college campuses going through denigrating Islam and keeping Islam away from the young people. And in my in one of the chapters of my book, I said, I asked who to blame for slavery and how I figured it out. And through my research, and especially reading Ali Mazrui, the African, Ali Mazrui, you know, the Portuguese was led by Henry the Navigator. They, you know, he was more or less a teacher. And he taught, the science of seafaring. And he had a school in Portugal in the 1400s, and as his students learned from him, they started going down the coast of Africa, exploring the coast of Africa. And each year he sent more and more ships down the coast of Africa, and he met African traditional religious people, traditional religious. Now, you have to understand the Portuguese and the Spanish had hundreds of years of fighting the Muslims up in Spain and other places. So in a sense, they were like warriors. So they were looking for a way to defeat the Muslims. And as they went down the coast of Africa over these hundreds of years, they started arming the African traditional religious people and sending them into the interior of Africa where the Muslims were. You know, the Muslims were around the Niger River and the Congo River. And in order to defeat us, and then as time went on, the slave trade grew. The African traditional religious people started bringing out the Muslims out from the interior of Africa, and loading us on slave ships. So like in that chapter, who to blame for slavery? I kind of sum it up like that. Alhamdulillah. So
yes, sir. Yeah, thank you for that contribution. You know, what's coming out in this conversation, and plus what you just shared, brother, there are so many contributors. I think Dr. LRD said earlier that no one gets away scot-free on that particular issue there. And that your book is a very good book. I hope you can get to the point to where you can, I know it's work writing the book, but still, if you can get to a point where you can republish that book, I think it would do a lot, because it's a nice book and a very good contribution. But if I may, we got about 12 minutes left. I got a question I want to ask our guest. But also I wanted to go back, Dr. LRD, one book that mentions about the encounter between Gandhi and Dr. Howard Thurman is a book titled Race, A History Beyond Black and White by Mark Arison, Aronson. That is just for the record. But the question I want to ask, and we don't have enough time, but we're going to try and squeeze it in. Maybe we can. I'm again with Dr. El Hadid. This is talking about give us some independent African-American theology in Islam that speaks directly to the African-American experience, someone who has made significant contributions with African-American theology within the Muslim experience, for the African-American experience, but that came from Islam. And the same question to go to Dr. King. Identify for us independent African-American theology within Christianity that speaks to the African-American experience. Dr. El-Hadi?
Yes, of course, the person that readily comes to my mind, of course, would be Elijah Malik El-Sabah's comment on as, you know, as Malcolm X. He is a man that was brought up under the teachings of Marcus Garvey, you know, by his parents until he was maybe about 14 years old, and then he went into the street life and got locked up. And when he came out, he went into, he converted to Islam under the teachings of the Nation of Islam, and was from that point mentored by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But he, when he went in, he saw, you know, that the Nation of Islam as a continuation of what Gandhi was talking about. That's what attracted him to it, because that was really what his parents had taught him. So, you know, Gandhi was talking about one God, one aim, you know, one destiny. A few mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. And then, of course, as you know from your book, you indicate, all of us know as well, that something happened in paradise, and Honorable Elijah Muhammad had a relationship with Malcolm as like a surrogate son. And so that relationship sort of had some difficulty, and he came out, and then, of course, he went and made the pilgrimage, and he went into, you know, Sunni Islam. But he was always maintained that Pan-African perspective that he got from Marcus Garvey. But when I look at him, I see him as a combination of a Muslim and a Pan-African statesman. You know, so he sort of seemed to be in balance in that way.
You're right, and I think some will argue that that would be more of a nationalistic or maybe even a cultural expression, but from a religious, and the reason why I use the word theology, I know that's not the best word, but from a theological perspective of what did Malcolm bring, or would there be other people? For us, what did, okay, we have Islam, African-Americans, what has Islam brought from this book, from this teaching, this practice that's going to speak to my African-American life?
You asked me what now?
Yes, you know, from a theological, from a religious study of the scripture or study of the religion, what has come forth from Islam that's going to speak to the African-American experience from a theological or religious?
So what are some of the teachings in Islam that will speak to the African-American experience, that's what you asked me?
Okay. Has there been any person to bring out?
I would say let me come at it from this standpoint. If you look at you know, these two movements, you know, the Nation of Islam, if you look at Nobu Drew Ali and the Moorish Science Temple, I see all of it as, you know, as evolution, you know, starting out with the idea that African Americans are members of the lost found Nation of Islam, that we are colonized people inside of America. So it all starts out as nationalism. Even those brothers who were in the Ahmadiyya movement, they were in there because they were beboppers too, you know. And the bebop movement, as you know, was a nationalistic type movement. These brothers had gone into World War II, and they came back over here pushing back, you know, against racism. So I think it all started out as a nationalist type of thing. Then it evolved. You know, Malcolm evolved to become more Sunni. Imam Muhammad, you know, evolved to become Sunni. So I think it's sort of an evolutionary process. But if you leave behind the history and the culture piece, and then you have a religion that's generic, it's not going to be very useful to African Americans. African Americans are clearly dealing with white supremacy, so you got to speak back to white supremacy. They're clearly dealing with institutionalized racism. So, I mean, you just can't, tiptoe around that in order to say, well, I'm going to, speak about an Islam that has no adjectives to it and that has no cultural context or historical context. And then when you push it all the way back to the African continent, when you go back to the African continent, when Islam came into West Africa, those brothers did not give up being Wolofs or Mandinkas or Hausas. On the other hand, when Islam went into West Africa, where there was intermarriages between Arabs and Africans, then they had a different kind of interpretation. But West Africans and Central Africans, they always embraced pride in their ethnicity. They never gave that up to this very day. And we are from the West African and Central Africa. I see no reason why we should give up our culture and our ethnicity just because we are Muslim.
I agree.
Is what I'm saying.
Yes, sir. Very well stated. Dr. King, let me face the question so you'd be fresh in your mind. Has there been any independent African-American theology or teachings from the Christian experience that speaks to the African-American experience? And if so, what is it and by who?
Without a doubt, in my mind, I'd encourage people to read a book authored by James Cone, God of the Oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then follow his other publications, but I'd ask people to start there first, God of the Oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
Then one other statement I wanted to make. I think black folks in America were seduced during the time of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We should have paid more attention to the teachings he tried to give us. I look at Elijah Muhammad as a certain nationalist, black nationalist, but also an economist. If we had paid attention to him, we need to stop being consumer slaves and chart our own destiny. We needed to create our own economy in America as other minorities have done. So I just said, and I say it there consistently, we allowed the media to seduce us into not listening to sound teaching on how black folks in America can be successful and not just survivors. So that's my comment.
Yes, sir. Yeah, thank you. And thank you both. We're down to our last 5 minutes, and there's so much more that could be covered. I think we covered quite a bit. We could digest so far. I do want to give you both maybe a couple of minutes. If there's anything that I may not have asked or said that you would like to interject or to share with the listeners, can you please do that? Take a couple of minutes each. Dr. El-Hadi, if you have anything, if you don't mind going first, anything we may have overlooked that you think is important to share that's connected with this topic?
I would say this. We didn't say enough about, or hardly said anything about Dr. Martin Luther King and how he used Christianity as a liberation theology. I think Muslims would do well to study, Dr. King very carefully, especially because, people get fixated on the I Have Dreamed Dr. King. But if you seriously study Dr. King after Selma, from 65 going forward, then you're looking at a revolutionary Dr. King. And that's what that meant we talked about, Yeah, that would be my point.
Yes, sir. Yeah, maybe we can do this again, and that could be the topic of what you're saying reminds me, and this is very interesting, too, I think, for people to know. Imam W.D. Muhammad, the son of Elijah Muhammad, the last national Juma, our Friday service is called Juma, the last one we had with him at the convention in Detroit, it'd be September, Labor Day weekend, 2008, he spent a significant amount of time during the Friday holy service for Muslims talking about Dr. King and us to study Dr. King. Just the same thing what you just said. I think it's quite interesting that you, Dr. El-Hadi, the Muslim, and Imam W.D. Muhammad, the leader of thousands, hundreds, thousands, millions of Muslims, both had the same concept that we should be looking at some things of Dr. King. And I like how you gave us a timeline to look at the post-Selma Dr. King, 1965, after Selma, you see a different Dr. King. But I'm going to segue upon that. We have the nephew of Dr. King with us. I'm not sure what he may say, but you're free to say whatever you want to say, Dr. King, Derek King. You got about a minute or two.
Well, first of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity to be in this conversation. Dr. Al-Hadid, I took some good notes. I would hope to get to meet you personally one day somewhere. Final comment is, Imam Michael Sahir, keep doing what you're doing, brother. Keep educating us. Keep educating us and keep holding us accountable.
Well, yes, sir. Whether I can do that, if you all would do the same toward me. Y'all keep teaching me and keep holding me accountable, because we're all in this together. Alhamdulillah, praise be to God. So let's work on everything we just said, including getting you two to meet in some kind of way. Let's see if we can make that happen, inshallah, God willing.
Okay.
Dr. El-Hadi, Brother Mustafa, I'm sorry. I'd like to get a closing word from you in about a minute. Mm.
Brother Imam, I'm all right, Brother Imam. I'm sitting on ready right now, ready to push the rewind button. I just want to go back and listen to this history all over again, because I just couldn't take in all that Dr. B and Dr. Dave were giving. So I had to go back and listen to this show again. I'm just sitting there waiting to push the rewind button. It's on archive.
Okay. Yes, well, that's important to know, because these shows are archived. All our shows are archived. And you can go back, and if you have the link, you can hit the link again. If you don't have the link, go to Google, type in my name, Michael Sahir, type in words made people, talking Dr. El-Hadi, that's spelled A-L-H-A-D-I-D, and you can type in Dr. Derek, D-E-R-E-K, Barber, like you go get your haircut, Derek Barber King, and you should be able to find this show and listen to it and share with your friends. So we are down to our last 10, 20 seconds. I know we can go on and on, but thank you, I guess, Dr. El-Hadi, thank you. Dr. King, Derek King, thank you. And a big thanks to our listening audience for listening to and supporting Words Made People. Join us again next Sunday, and we will try this once again. If you have any ideas for a topic, just let me know. Thank you. God, peace be with you. As-salamu alaykum.
Alaykum as-salamu alaykum.
if a nursing college cared for its students the same way nurses cared for their patients? What if the focus was on keeping students in, not weeding them out? What would happen? Something extraordinary. Join us, and together we can make a difference. Chamberlain University College of Nursing. Extraordinary care. Extraordinary.